Well, thank you, Paul. Thank you all for coming in for this. It is, it has been a, you know, great pleasure to be here. Sometimes I actually feel, you know, when you walk in the downtown and people sitting outside having coffee, like it's very unfair compared to, you know, people in the East Coast. This is a great place to be at this time of the year. I'll be talking about some of the work that we have been doing over the years on cold collisions involving both chemistry and inelastic scattering. Yesterday we had a really nice talk about some chemical reactions and how you can actually push experiments into the Mealy-Kelvin regime. Obviously in this audience, we don't need to kind of motivate why we want to do cold chemistry. Depending upon who you ask, you know, you will get different answers as why, you know, it is interesting to study chemical reactions at low temperatures. Obviously, I think many of us agree, some of the items on this list that we would like to explore, reactions at low temperatures, well, look at the issues of how long-range forces influence reactivity, how we control reactions using electric and magnetic field, explore quantum effects, and the quantum collective effect on chemical reactions. In some cases, actually, you may be able to prepare reactants, both the reactants and products in specific quantum states. I will, if I get time, I will talk about some resonant and quasi-resonant transitions where this selectivity is not just in the initial reactants, but also in the final state. I think there is a growing, you know, consensus that by studying collisions and reactions at temperatures in the Mealy-Kelvin regime, one may be able to also understand processes occurring in astrophysical environments. I think, you know, there's a general trend in that direction as well. What I would like to start with is to discuss what, you know, what are the key issues involved in studying, in describing chemical reactions. There are essentially, you know, four steps involved in calculating rate constants for chemical reactions. The key steps are the first three. First, you have to do the electronic structure calculations to evaluate the potential energy surface or surfaces involved in the process. For that, there are many well-established codes available. That community is kind of well-developed. There have been a lot of effort put over the last 20, 30 years in developing both free codes as well as commercially available codes to perform electronic structure calculations. Many of us in this, you know, group as well use some of these codes, particularly the MOLPRO. The second task is to, you know, take this electronic structure data and fit into some useful functional form that can be input, you know, adapted for the dynamics calculations. That, again, has been a very challenging topic, and there are not many groups in the world who can do a really good job on that. Now, in the cold collision field, we also know that the long-range interaction is very important. And many potential surfaces that chemists have calculated, and even some of them that we have used in low-energy calculations, do not have a good representation of the long-range interaction. That, I think, yes.
Interesting point. I think it's worth making on this. I'll just see if you have a comment on it. That Eberhard told us about the atom-atom potential case and how they use spectroscopy to get these very precise potentials. I think in your case, when you're dealing with chemistry, essentially there's virtually no cases where you have good empirical potentials like that. You have to rely almost totally on ab initio.
Exactly. And that will also be reflected in some of the results I present where I have very little experimental data to compare with, particularly at low temperatures. So that is a very key issue, and I think maybe Gerrit will have some answer to that as you know, he computes potentials, he does scattering calculations, he collaborates with people who may do measurements. So I think Gerrit, I think is I think in a much you know better position to shed some light on that as well. The second part, or the third part, is using dynamics calculations using these potential surfaces. And again, I must say, in many cases, electronically non-adiabatic dynamics is important, that scattering on a single potential surface is not appropriate for many open-shell systems. So that itself, even at higher collision energies, is a challenging topic in the chemical dynamics community. And I don't think there have been much investigation of ultracold reactions on multiple potential surfaces. And I think putting this out there as this community, if for the future development, I think that is one of the topics people would like to pay some attention to. And for the collision dynamics, in the chemical physics community, there is trajectory-based methods. So essentially, you integrate Newton's or Hamilton's equations of motion. Semi-classical method, you treat some degrees of freedom classically, some degrees of freedom quantum mechanically, somehow account for, say, tunneling effects, or account for zero-point energy effects in classical trajectory calculations, or some other sort of semi-classical formalism. Or if you want, you can do the full quantum dynamics calculation. There is for ultracold collisions. I don't think other than applying some of the long range, like Langevin type of approach. But I have myself done at a higher temperature semi-classical calculations where you can treat certain degrees of freedom quantum mechanically. For example, in an atom diatom or diatom diatom collision, you can treat the vibrations quantum mechanically. You can treat the rotations and relative translation motions classically. Then you can use some sort of an effective Hamiltonian to combine classical and quantum dynamics. And that is very conveniently done within the time-dependent approach, which I will kind of briefly talk about in the next slide. And once we have a cross-sections computed for a large number of energies, you integrate it over Boltzmann distribution of relative velocities and calculate rate constants. So that is kind of the easiest part of the calculations. But now let us talk about quantum mechanical approaches. So there is kind of these two. Yeah.
Before we go there, can I ask a question?
Uh-huh.
Or I think that one interesting thing to think about is the difference between the atom-atom scattering, which we all know so well and can do so precisely,
yes.
And the molecule scattering. It's basically, would you say it's basically the very large number of degrees of freedom you get when you start getting molecules?
Exactly.
Many more degrees of freedom that essentially make basis set methods challenging.
And
require you to go to these classical semi-classical. In other words, all the degrees of freedom treating simultaneously, all the rotations, vibrations, angular and so forth.
Yes.
Simply beyond the scope of quantum dynamics.
For many systems of, particularly in the cold collision field, when we have three alkylimethyl, alkylimethyl trimer systems or a tetramer systems, it is almost hopeless to try to do this. In fact, I will come back to that basis set thing in the next couple of slides.
Okay. Side of that is the fact that in the two-body problem, you really have a good connection between scattering and bound and quasi-bound states, especially the quasi-bound resonances which in spectroscopy are observed and also in scattering are observed. You don't have anything like that really for any, even a triatomic system. It's not there. You don't have that connection.
Is it because the level structure becomes chaotic?
No, it's just complex. Space? It's not chaotic in many cases. I mean, there are cases where it's chaotic.
But
there
are statistical methods used nowadays.
Right. But I don't know that it's. Do you know any cases where,
There are
things like Van der Waals molecules with a diatomic and an atom bound together, and the decomposition of those can be treated fairly quantum mechanically.
I think it's a very good point, Bill, that the molecules are really fundamentally different in many ways from the atoms. And right. One of the things that this community that knows a lot about atom-atom scattering and fish box and so forth are going to have to think differently when we get to the molecule, simply because of their complexity, the sheer complexity.
Yes.
But Paula's going to tell us about some of that complexity.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you can, you know, depending upon what you like, you can either use a time-dependent quantum approach or a time-independent. And again, in the last, I would say, 20 years or so, the chemical physics community has moved more to the left here, to the time-dependent approach for primarily for computational reasons. So if you have a, you know, so let's talk about time-dependent. And if your Hamiltonian is actually time-independent, then you can, you know, you can write the time evolution as the exponential evolution operator operating on the wave function. So essentially, the method involves you prepare your initial wave function that corresponds to some initial state of your reactants. And so it could be for an atom-to-atom system, product of vibration, rotation, and translation wave functions. You discretize that into large number of grid points, and then the propagation of the wave function is essentially action of this evolution operator on the wave function, and it boils down to repeated action of the Hamiltonian on the wave function. So you never construct a full Hamiltonian matrix. You have a matrix, you know, at the most a matrix vector operation during each time step of the evolution. And finally, you have the scattered wave function where, you know, you have some wave function scattered into the products and maybe some inelastically scattered as well, and you analyze to find out how much is reacted. And so that has become the choice, the method of choice in the chemical physics community. And because it is an initial value problem, that you start with an initial wave packet and then propagate to the final state, the scaling is much more favorable. And there are methods that have been developed that involves a fast Fourier transform technique that will take from a grid representation to a momentum representation where you can evaluate the kinetic energy part of the Hamiltonian in a locally there. So this repeated transformation from grid to momentum through fast Fourier transform allows you to evaluate both the potential energy operator and the kinetic energy operator in the appropriate local representation, makes the computation scalars much more favorably, like n log n, compared to say n cubed in the time independent approach.
Well, yes. One point about time domain approaches,
yes.
They're really good if something comes in and goes out.
Yes.
If something goes in and resonates.
That is a challenge.
Like that,
yes.
For a long
yes.
time. Then is part
so,
of it?
So you know, my first intuition or my first impulse was when I got into this one, try to see, because I had, you know, prior experience on time dependent approaches, try to see if this works for cold collisions. And I was wrong, and I at least I couldn't get it working. And the issue is that in grid-based methods, you discretize your wave packet, and the wave packet begin to spread as you propagate in time. And so you have, in any case, only a finite number of grid points, and there is this reflection from the grid boundaries. And what is usually used is an absorbing potential to absorb the wave packet as it reaches toward the grid boundaries. Now, you cannot construct a perfect absorbing potential. There is always some reflection, and that becomes a big of a problem at low energies than at, say, somewhat higher energies. And so I think, again, you know, for this, those of you here, if you can find a really perfect absorbing potential, and that might actually help with you know, some of the issues with the time dependent. Then of course, you know, if it is complex forming, you had to propagate it for much, much longer time, and maybe at low energies that you may be able to use much larger time steps.
The question about the absorbing potential.
Yes.
I mean, the kinds of things like Ed was doing and that we've done in the past with complex potentials just in atom-atom calculations, we can get those that are gentle enough that there's essentially negligible reflection. So essentially the problem doesn't seem to happen in these one coordinate problems. Is there something about the molecules that make the getting non-reflecting absorbing potentials more difficult? Or?
I think the wave packet has a range of energies. The question is, how will you equally absorb all energy components? because you can construct a perfect absorbing potential to absorb one energy component.
Okay, well, that's
but in the time independent, you have only one energy at a time in the way you we do the scattering calculation. But the wave packet has a large number of energy component depending upon the initial spread in coordinate space. And the question is how you will construct a potential that will absorb all the energy component. So that is a challenge there. Yes.
How do you typically choose the wavelength? I mean, how should I understand? Is it a broad wavelength?
Yeah. Well, so depending upon the width in the coordinate space, it will have an appropriate. So usually what is used is a minimum uncertainty wave packet in the a minimum uncertainty Gaussian wave packet for the translation motion, multiplied by the vibration and rotational component, and so that is placed far out in the reactant channel. And then as you propagate, it will go to the interaction region and then bifurcate into the product channels. And then you, so depending upon what you want, if you can propagate, really not propagate that far into the product channel, just before putting the absorbing boundary, if you do the a flux analysis to find out the total reaction probability. But if you want the full rotational vibration result reaction probabilities of cross section, you propagate farther out into the product channel, and then you can analyze it for product state distributions.
So this is average over mean energies.
So the different energy components are obtained because you have the time-dependent wave packet. You do a time-to-energy Fourier transform, so you get all the energy components out of it. So that is why the chemical physics people they really like this technique, and most of I would say the development in reactive scattering in the last 10, 15, or 20 years. Have been focused on the development of time-dependent, and they were applied to 3-atom, 4-atom, and some some groups are trying to apply it to even larger systems.
I thought the time-dependent doesn't work because you have to create this wave packet built called atoms which send to move on time scales of say microseconds.
Yes, yes.
Even a potential they move have to move at picosecond time scale, so. Need to like
that is true. The different, yeah.
So you
expect to run it for microseconds. In the asymptotic regions, it is slow moving. But now, I mean, that is also the hard chemistry that I was. Because once you are in the deep well region, then it is not cold anymore. So there will be much more spread. Your initial distribution may be narrow, but then you end up much more spread out. So I think there are technical issues. There may be ways to handle it, but
we tried time domain methods in the ultracold back in the 1990s with Keith Burnett and Kaliati Solanaman and those people using wave packets. It works reasonably well for certain types of collisions around the millikelvin, perhaps a little bit lower than hundreds of microkelvin. When you get to microkelvin and these very diffuse wave packets, long to Broglie wavelength things, the time domain things didn't seem to work well at all.
Okay.
And an interesting question is how to put in something like photoassociation then spontaneous decay.
Yeah, yeah.
And the problem there, you get into the very slow time scale of coming together and then this fast time scale of oscillation. And if you put in open quantum open system of dissipation, it gets to be exceedingly difficult. So it's fascinating to think about these things. But,
I put it out there.
Has been really good in chemistry.
Yeah, just to emphasize that most of the recent development in reactive scattering has been using the time dependent.
And where it actually might be practical in a certain sense in the ultracold domain, if they have something in a lattice cell, two reactants in a lattice cell, they start from a well-posed initial condition. This wave function in the lattice cell, and then that can start evolving in time. So anyway, so then you don't have a long Broglie wave. You've got something in a finite volume.
That's right.
So it's essentially a bound state is an initial state that you put on your whatever your fields, control fields, and it starts evolving.
Yes.
So that may be a place where time domain
okay.
can attach to
the okay. control. So for all these issues that we just discussed, I think all of us realize that it is much more convenient to use the time-independent coupled channel approach to ultracold collisions, and so this is just a quick recipe to do a non-reactive inelastic atom-diatom scattering. So you expand your wave function in a basis of rotation vibrational states of the diatomic datum in a coupled angular momentum basis set in the total angular momentum representation, and putting this expansion into the Schrodinger equation, you get a large number of close coupling equations, and then you integrate using any, you know, any of your favorite numerical methods. And so this is kind of pretty standard approach. The only thing is you end up with a very large number of coupled equations. So let's just, you know, take that into the into a scattering of two diatomic molecules, just to illustrate how quickly you run into a very large number of coupled channel equations. So again, you know, for us, this implicit scattering of two H2 molecules is complicated enough, but you know, that is something doable in full dimensionality. So we have two H2 molecules, vibrational coordinates, the lid loss and the center of mass distance here. And again, using the same total angular momentum representation, you can construct a basis function that is your product of the vibrational and the rotational wave functions in this coupled angular momentum basis set. You have the rotational angular momentum coupled to give this JAB, which will combine with L to give the total angular momentum J and its projection. And put this into the Schrodinger equation, and again you get a large number of coupled equations that you solve. Now the issue is, in your basis set, of course, you know the way we normally do is you choose your basis set enough number of functions for the rotational vibrational motion, such that your results are converged with respect to the basis set. So we have some V1 max and V2 max for the vibrational quantum numbers of the two molecules, and J1 max and J2 max for the rotational quantum numbers, and this is the total angular momentum. You know, we will, unlike at ordinary temperatures, we may have to integrate to much larger radial separations. And for each V1, J1, V2, J2 combinations, we can compute cross sections for a large number of energies. And this actually does not, I mean, this is just for simple closed-shell molecules like H2. And some of the molecules like NH-NH scattering that Herit will talk about, maybe, you will also have to include spin and hyperfine interactions. So even without that, you will see the number of coupled equations can be very large. Now, another bottleneck we actually realized when we began doing this. I think I'll show you in the next slide.
Now, this large number of coupled equations, it comes from because the expansion itself is not very good, or because you have a higher energy?
The expansion, I mean, you may be able to use the total angular momentum representation that we use, but it is just because the number of, you can restrict the number of rotational levels, for example, because in the coupled channel equation to minimize the number of channels to be to be involved, but then your result will not be converged, and so it is just the large number of channels because you want the you want to include enough closed channels in your calculations that the results are converged.
So I have a problem. It's a similar idea. For some of these ultra-cold problems, but I have a single vibrational state, right, which was really bound, right, and I don't know, 5, 6 couple equations in the tree at very low energy. If I don't have many vibrational states, so I'm just curious if what's killing I never explore a push to the gene. Even this 7, 8 channels, it is really heavy in the sense that I have to calculate an integral, five-dimensional integral, so on. So it's not an easy calculation, and so this is an even tougher problem.
Asymptotically, they are quite separated. But as they come together, there is always, mixing of the higher lying rotational levels and vibration levels. So even though asymptotically you think, these levels are separated, But at short interaction distances, you know, there is those asymptotically closed channels do contribute, and that is why you will have to include many channels. Yes.
The anisotropy, right?
Yeah.
Molecule
yes.
interaction.
Yes. Let me just give an example. You know, try to do KRB, you know, two KRB molecules. I mean, let's suppose the potential is, well, that's reactive. Take a non-reactive something you want to do a collision for. But like convenient cesium, let's say 10 rotations in each get coupled together by the anisotropy. It's probably more like 100 rotations. But two molecules with 10 rotations are 100 channels. Two molecules with 100 rotations are 10,000 channels. Both rubidium cesium or potassium rubidium, if you put in the spin channels, have about order of 30 or 40 fold degeneracy in nuclear spin. Square that, you got 1,000 channels in spin, you got 10,000 channels in rotation, you get millions and millions of channels. He can't do
yeah,
it.
That is,
so
that
that's
is,
what he's going to tell you, I think.
That is precisely my point here.
He's just thinking about hydrogen. Okay.
Yeah. So you know, for simple diatomic systems such as this one, say, so this is the number of channels that you will be needing. And so if you just put V1, you know, 0 and 1, the first two vibration levels for the two molecules, and say 10 rotational levels for each of the molecules, then you easily, you know, come to, you know, order of what Paul was talking about. And this is without spin or anything. And so that is on the order of 50,000, and you may be able to reduce it by a factor of 2 if you separate, you know, the even and odd parity states and identical particle symmetrizer will give you another factor of 2, and you may be able to introduce an energy cutoff that any basis functions with, you know, energies above that cutoff, you ignore them. So this may be, you can reduce it by maybe about a factor of 10, but and in the case of H2, you can separate into ortho and para H2 if for inelastic scattering, that will reduce it by another. So you can do separately for ortho H2 and para H2. So there is a lot of some simplification can be introduced, but still we are talking.
We have to overlap this there too, right? Shouldn't there be an extra factor for the L? If it's not S-wave scattering, then.
That is right. Yeah, yeah.
Even worse than,
I mean, this would be for S-wave. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that is. And again, earlier, Harit was saying, depending upon the anisotropy of the interaction. So when you have higher order terms contributing, that you know, that will also increase the number.
Oh, what is the practical limit now in couple channels?
Again, I guess it depends upon who you ask as what their accessibility is to some supercomputing. I think we have we can do up to about 10,000 couple channels. Yeah, yeah. It gets. I don't know how you manage your system, but
not 4,000.
Yeah.
Is about
okay.
Right.
Okay. So we can. Yeah. But when you up to 5,000, okay. Yeah. But when you go from between 5 to 10,000, that is where it, you know, becomes really, really slow. So that is now. So far, I have you know talked mostly about inelastic scattering, but in reactive scattering, you have an additional complication. That is when they're due to the atom exchange. So whatever the coordinate system that you started with is not the coordinate system you need to describe the products. So there is a coordinate transformation that is needed. So for an A plus BC kind of system, you have the AB plus C, or you have the AC plus B arrangement channels. And in fact, this has been one of the most difficult aspects of reactive scattering calculations, how you do this coordinate change as you integrate your equations. And so people over the years, I mean, again, came up with different ideas. And one approach has been, instead of using the normal Jacobi coordinates, use hyperspherical coordinates. So you can define a hyperradius rho that is the same for all three arrangement channels. So you have a single radial coordinate. And then you can define two hyperangles that will decide which you know which arrangement channel you are. So by rotating by rotation of a kinematic rotation in one of the hyperangles, you can go from say the A plus A BC arrangement to the AB plus C or the AC plus B. So essentially, you can solve this as an inelastic problem. But again, every time when you introduce a coordinate instead of three distances or two distances and angle, then you have one distance and two angles, you know, there is additional numerical issues associated with that. But So this is the approach that we have used in some of the calculations that we have done, and as I indicated earlier, there have been a lot of development in the electronic structure calculations. There are standard codes available, but for reactive scattering calculations, most of the developments have been individual research group, whatever they have worked on, whatever last 10, 20, 30 years in their group. And these codes have remained largely within individual research group, and there has generally been in some sort of an unwillingness to share the codes in the community. But there is one code which is by David Manolopoulos and his group. They made it available for general use. It is called the ABC code, which is implemented in this hyperspherical coordinates. And so essentially what you do is you expand the wave function in what are called hyperspherical harmonics or surface functions. And so that you divide the hyperradius into a large number of sectors. And at each sector, you expand this wave function in terms of the hyperspherical harmonics, and then put it into the Schrodinger equation. That will give you a large number of, again, coupled equations. You propagate from rho equal to some small value, rho equal to 0 to large value of the hyperradius, and then you analyze it for scattering attributes. So the issue is what kind of functions you will use to expand the surface functions. And in the ABC code, the functions that are the surface functions are expanded in terms of at each row, in terms of sort of a vibration, in each of the arrangement channels, it is expanded in an approximate rotation vibration state of the diatomic fragment, and that is actually good in asymptotic distance. But as you come in shorter distance, when there is a deep three-body triatomic potential well, then these basis functions are not really good basis functions to describe the triatomic system. So when we try to apply the ABC code to reactions with the deep potential wells, we always run into convergence issues. You can include as many rotational vibration levels in the calculations as you can, but it is really hard to converge. But it works quite well for barrier reactions. So almost a dozen years ago, when we started looking at cold reactive collisions, so we first thought, okay, we will try to apply it to well-known system, the fluorine plus H2, which is a benchmark a chemical reaction problem in the chemical physics community. So you have F and H2 come together. There is sort of in a van der Waals well region, followed by a barrier, which is about 400 Kelvin, and then the reaction occurs through tunneling. And there is tremendous amount of work that was done on this. So if you start with the vibrationally and rotationally ground state H2, HF is produced in different vibration levels, and the most probable vibration level is V prime equal to 2. And in fact, this distribution extends to higher energies as well. And that is why the F plus H2 has been quite a bit of interest to the chemical dynamics people, because it creates, chemical reaction creates vibrationally excited product. So in the chemical laser field, this was kind of an important reaction. So anyway, for us, the take-home message was that the cross-sections are fairly large at low temperatures, and the limiting value of the Reed constant is about 1 times 10 to the minus 12. And this was just an exploratory calculation. Obviously, if you had a different, more accurate F plus H2 potential, this value would be different. If you include spin orbit coupling in the fluorine atom, it could change as well. But this was just an exploratory work. But the fact is that despite an energy barrier of 400 Kelvin, the reactivity is still measurable, and this value is comparable to the room temperature rate constant for this reaction.
And Paul, just one question you mentioned about the spins. Typically, because of the difficulty with vibrations and rotations, you have to leave out spin structure in these kind of things. Do you do the fluorine P1/2, P3/2 difference, or is that neglected?
Essentially, it is. So when you have the excited spin orbit WP1/2, so there is an adiabatic interaction between the P3/2 and the P1/2. And that makes an additional contribution. So Millard Alexander has recently done a calculation that includes a spin orbit coupling, and this value is is somewhat modified if you use the spin-orbit coupling. I don't remember the exact number.
So that's adding like what, three times more channels, or six times more channels or so?
I think so. I don't recall all the data.
So you're already pushing your calculational ability to the limit with vibrations, rotations, and the spin makes it even harder.
That is right.
Nuclear spin is essentially impossible, so you never do that.
Yeah. And that, you know, at ordinary temperature, this is not maybe not significant, and then chemists kind of, they never bother about that. And so this is another example of a barrier reaction, lithium plus AHF. Okay, here I get my polar molecule here. But this reaction occurs by tunneling of the fluorine ion. If you look at the reactant and the product here, and so the reaction is actually the cross sections are really small. You can vibrationally excite the HF and then get high reactivity. But the interesting thing is, even though it involves tunneling of the fluorine atom, the reactive rate is larger than the non-reactive vibrational quenching for the V equal to 1 reaction. So, and that we have seen in a number of cases when you vibrationally excite, the probability for the chemical reaction is comparable or larger than the vibrational quenching. Now, so when we apply this ABC code to systems with a D potential well, we ran into problems, and so when Brian Kendrick from Los Alamos came to UNLV to give a talk some years ago, I discussed with him, and he said, well, we have a different code that Russ Pack and Parker and others have developed in the 80s, and then they continued to develop to the 90s, and that is actually much more useful to look at reactions with the deep potential wells. And that is called, sometimes they're called APH, hyperspherical coordinates, or symmetrized hyperspherical coordinates. The main difference is how the two angles are chosen. The hyperradius is the same as before. And so in this case, it is a much more kind of complicated strategy that they have used. In the strong interaction region, that is where here from the small rho up to some intermediate value, so this would be where your triatomic well is situated, you use a different set of basis functions to expand the hyperspherical surface functions. And that would be much more suited to describe the bound state of the triatomic species. Then you switch to the Dell's hyperspherical coordinates some at intermediate distance where the coupling is less strong. And then you continue to, so you match it onto the Dell's functions and continue to propagate in Dell's hyperspherical coordinates up to some asymptotic distance where you transform to Jacobi coordinates and then do the boundary conditions.
What's the typical rho max over rho?
So again, it depends on the system. So at ordinary temperature, say if you are looking at some reaction involving H2 and say H2 plus H or some other, the entire region you can restrict to about 10 to 15 atomic unit. That is all what you need, because at higher energies, the long range is not that important. But in some of our calculations, up to rho max, about 15 atomic unit is enough up to rho max. But for some of the low energy calculations we are doing, not even the alkali systems, the intermediate rho is about 15 atomic unit. And then from 15 to about 35 to 40 atomic unit would be the Dell's region. But I'll show you some work. We began some other calculation on some system, Li to YB. We were just setting up. We have to go up to about 35 atomic unit in this region alone. Only then we can actually match onto these functions here. So it depends on what your, how is the interaction of what the molecules are composed of. You may have to extend this region into much larger range to be able to. Yeah.
Just make a brief comment aside on this, but this the separation into different regions and appropriate methods for different regions is very helpful. I just want to make a comment that it's one of the kinds of things you do in quantum defect theory.
Yes. And
you have this long-range part that you treat one way, maybe even exactly with full couple channels, and in the small range part, you replace by some kind of quantum defect
yes,
matrix.
Yes.
But of course, the quantum defect matrix is enormous, and you know it could have thousands of channels in it, and of course that makes it very difficult. So, you know, one of the things John Bone has been doing is putting statistical approximations in. That may not be right either. That's just one kind of approximation. So, figuring out how to make this separation,
yes,
I
yes.
think, is very important for this
yeah.
field and how it works in the ultra
yeah.
world. So that's just a comment. So,
And again, for us, like, you know, where do you draw this line? You draw it here or here. So there is a lot of, you know, I mean, that is your convergence test studies, and so again, it is something, you know, by trial and error, you had to find out where, you know, what would be the appropriate distance. You can also look at the potential, and generally, once you do on a few systems, you get a fairly good idea where you, you know, draw that line. But it is based on our experience. This is a region where you can spend more than 95% of the computing time, and you would like to restrict it to as small a region as possible. But when you work with molecules like Li2 or KRb, where the internuclear distance of the molecule is like 6 to 8 atomic unit, you know, then your range of interaction is so wide that you cannot restrict it into a small range. So we have applied this to, in fact, this is an ongoing calculation. Again, clearly of not significant interest to the core Christian community. But this is just like H plus H2, this is one of the bench, or like fluorine plus H2 for a barrier reaction. Or singularity plus H2 has been a benchmark system for insertion reactions in the chemical physics community. And we thought, okay, this may be an interesting candidate to look at a barrierless complex forming reaction at low energies. And this, so when all singularity and H2 come together, they form the bound state of the water molecule, the ground state of the water molecule. So it's very, very deeply bound. And that is why you have, you know, thousands of raw vibration levels of the water molecule needs to be, you know, reasonably well represented as you do the scattering.
Just a very quick question here. Since both H2 and O singlet D have quadrupole moments, is the quadrupole interaction important at all at long range?
I think
essentially not treated.
Yeah, but I think the potential surface that I have used, I don't think it has that included. So it is a potential that was used to do the higher energy calculation, but it should be included if you want accurate, you know, results at low energy.
Well, the protocols are very small, so it may actually not make much difference. So I'm just wondering if it's actually known whether it make a difference or not.
You know, we haven't separately did that calculation, but I think, but maybe not. In fact, maybe not, because I have some data to show that it may not be important. But by the way, I presented some preliminary result at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union last month in San Francisco. There is an aeronomy community that is interested in this kind of process as well. There's quite a bit of interest in this reaction, not just in combustion in atmospheric, but also in lightning. During lightning, you have extremely high temperatures and all-singularity, high energy all-singularity and vibrationally excited H2 are produced, and to describe that process, they would like to see this reaction study at much more higher energies and excited vibrational levels of H2. So that might be, you know, on the side we might be doing. So this is in the from the raw to the raw intermediate region. This is just in the deep part of the potential. So if you look at the hyperspherical surface function, so this is basically the energies of the surface function, the adiabatic energies as a function of the hyperradius. So this is what we run into, these very, very large number of channels, and then you have many bound or quasi-bound state represented by in this well. So that is where Paul, you were saying that is there a way that we can get around by really not worrying about this one? And so that is where your quantum defect theory comes into picture. But of course, then you will not get any information about what products are formed.
But the problem with quantum defect theory is that there's so many channels that it's not clear one could apply a meaningful kind of quantum defect theory. So the statistical theories that John Bone is doing is interesting because that replaces all of that stuff by statistics. What I suspect is the reality is that it's not statistical. And it's not one of the two channels, but you know, we got to figure out what's going on in there, and that's really hard.
So I mean, there I have some for this system. I have some evidence that indicates it may be statistical. That is because you can study this reaction with a different vibration level of H2, And I see there is really no sensitivity to the reaction. This is only for S wave in the incident channel. So for H2 vehicles 0, 1, and 2, the reaction cross sections are essentially the same. Now, here, so, you know, as you go to higher rows, these asymptotically approach the various rotational vibration levels of the H2 and the OH molecules. So I cannot, you know, I have not labeled which one is the H2, which one is OH, because there are...
So you show no evidence of resonances.
Actually, the reason is that, so, you know, the resonances are not long-lived in this case.
Okay.
They are because, you know, of the high energies involved. So many of the, I think the H2 levels are somewhere around here, and OH levels are below here. But the thing is, doesn't matter whether you start here or here.
Okay.
Once you form this complex, then it decays more in a statistical fashion.
Because the interesting question, I think, in things like this is whether do the two products, reactants come together and they zip together in a picosecond and then fly apart a picosecond later, no resonances, or do they sit there and move around for and resonate for a nanosecond or so, and then you pick up
So
you're saying it's basically a straight through.
It is not straight through. There are some resonances, but they are relatively short-lived.
They're so short-lived, they hardly make a difference.
Yeah.
And your picture was not thermally averaged, right?
It is not.
Okay.
In fact, if I go to somewhat higher, there are some oscillations if I go to a little bit higher energies, but essentially there are not many. But this only S waves, so of course many other partial waves need to be included, and then we will see some resonance structure. But again, the interesting thing is this is the reaction rate for the three different vibrational levels. This is for vehicle 1 and vehicle 2, they can have a non-reactive quenching, and that's about an order of magnitude smaller. So very kind of interesting situation again. Now, the good thing about doing it, so if you're able to do this full-fledged thing, you can get the distribution of vibrational populations of the OH molecule. So this is for H2, vehicle 0, vehicle 1, and vehicle 2, and then this is the population or distribution of the OH in various vibrational level. The interesting thing, maybe I just would like to highlight, so you can see this is at a collision energy of about a microkelvin. This is an EV. This is about maybe about 1 Kelvin, and this is about room temperature. So the distribution remains roughly the same for vehicle 0, vehicle 1, and vehicle 2. And that's about some 7-8 orders of magnitude in energy. So in the once you are in the ultra cold regime, then the product distributions are unaffected, and you can also go to the extent of resolving the rotational population. So again, I just gave a contrast in the ultra cold regime, something around a microkelvin, and here at about maybe 1,000 Kelvin. The distributions are somewhat narrower here. So there seems to be a little bit higher specificity of product formation compared to, say, a much more spread out distribution in rotational populations at a higher temperature. So, we have applied this to different systems. The OH plus O is another reaction of interest to the chemical physics community, to the atmospheric chemistry community, where ozone and hydrogen reactor form OH in vibration levels up to vehicle to 9. And the aeronomy community would like to know what would be the vibration level specific decay of OH. And that is because if you go up in the mesosphere, there are really not many radiating species. You have OH and maybe some nitric oxide, but mostly others are neutral species. And the way to monitor other neutral species is to look at the OH, how OH decays. So there is, and there is also interest in astrophysics, where OH chemistry has been strongly, linked to the oxygen chemistry in the interstellar medium. So now here you can see a large number of resonances in the reaction probability, and these corresponds to when OH and O come together, the quasi-bound levels of the HO2 radical that are formed. And here, we just show some comparison from our calculation, that is the dark one, with that of a different group using the time-dependent wave packet method. And you see, both can give you really good results. So this is on one potential. We have done calculations on a different potential as well. But of course, the results are very different on the different potential.
If you change the potential, do you find big differences, or qualitatively it kind of stays like?
The Russians' positions are sort of shifted. It's not exactly the same. In fact, I had another. I should have included a slide on the other potential on this one, but I would say they are. But when you average over the thing, then it is not really a big difference. But individual reference are different. So this is sort of what is the status of this system, and a lot of people care about this because you can see these measurements. There have been a lot of measurements of rate constant up to temperatures about 200 Kelvin. But in the this reaction has some interest in mesosphere where the temperature is about 160 to 180 Kelvin, and there are really not much measurements in that region. These two measurements, I think this is using the Kreisu technique that that you discussed yesterday, gave. So this is about 40 Kelvin. This is about 120 Kelvin. They give within these error bars essentially temperature independent value, and that seems to be quite different from the temperature dependence of these measurements. And maybe your technique could be used to study this up to maybe up to about 5 Kelvin or a Kelvin or whatever, and really could show some light as what should be the temperature dependence. And so this is our calculations on one of the potential for HO2, and this is for the other potential. So, within maybe about a 20-25% difference in the rate, yes.
Another question: if you, it's not technically meaningful for this kind of reaction, but if you put on a Langevin capture cross section in here, do you know where that?
Yeah, we have done.
I mean, is it like well above this, or kind of goes?
It goes something like this. So it seems to be kind of in the ballpark, but it doesn't exactly show this behavior. I think we have a PRI paper in which we compared this to the Langevin, and I just didn't include.
And is the calculation done at the level, is the oxygen triple P structure treated at all, or is it just structureless P, no fine structure?
There is no fine structure.
And the OH is a double OH, pi, but without the lambda.
So it is approximated as a single sigma mark during this calculation.
Okay.
So again, this is a lot of details kind of, ignored or just you can do a very, very hard calculation on that, but we have not attempted. We did look at the effect of vibration excitation, so this may be something interesting to the audience here. So if you study the vehicle zero reaction, we get a much bigger value for the rate at low temperature. But if I excite OH to vehicle to 1, then it is much smaller. And that is where we suspected that it might be, because for the vehicle 0 case, there might be a very, very weakly bound state close to the threshold. And we know that it can influence the scattering at low energies. And just to see if that is indeed the case, we took the potential and multiplied it by a factor. That is the lambda scanning, but we use alpha here instead of lambda. So when alpha equal to 1, that is the actual potential we get for V equal to 0, this value. But when you change it by, just 1 plus or minus 1%, it is decreased by an order of magnitude for 0.99 and about a factor of 5 or so forth. So then it became comparable to the V equal to 1 rate. This is inelastic, that is vibrational quenching. This is the reactive. So when it is, when by modifying the potential, if the bound state either moves out into the continuum or moves down, that is when the value becomes comparable to that of V equal to 1. And we just completed a calculation for V equal to 2. And the result seems to be comparable to that of V equal to 1, something around 10 to the minus 12, and that's the value here for V equal to 1. And you can also see these, as you vibrationally excite OH, these resonances are not very prominent anymore. They get kind of washed out.
Have you tested the sensitivity of product distributions to the alpha, or do they particularly if you have resonant kind of phenomena.
Yeah.
Will they be also sensitive to the total rate, or?
We have not looked at, we have the data, but we have not looked at, okay. Yeah.
What interesting thing
it'll be interesting, yes.
About the problem
is
whether, because the entrance channel is maybe very cold, and it's very sensitive to subtle effects of resonances and scattering effects and so forth, but the exit channels are all extremely high energy and very different, and so in a sense you can kind of factor a collision into a half collision coming in and a half collision going out, and how the two connected. I think that's kind of an interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have the data.
Whether the product distributions are less sensitive or similar sensitivity or something, that's something we want to know the answer
to. Okay. Yeah, that's just looking at the data. Okay. So I think I have maybe 5 minutes or so, and I will quickly go through a few other items. So this is something. So this approach using the symmetrized hyperspherical coordinate, we think is probably one of the better approach out there to look at reactive systems with deeply bound triatomic intermediate and. So one system that Svetlana is working on is the LIYB. There are attempts being made, experimental attempts being made to create flashback LIYB molecules, and I'm not sure if that is realized, but anticipating such experiments and anticipating similar systems that that experimentalists might create, so we thought we just began setting up the calculations to see if that is something which we can handle. So this is just at the early stages of computation, but we realized we have to go up to about 30 atomic unit in the raw intermediate in this case would be about 30-35 atomic unit rather than about 12 to 15 atomic unit for the all singularity plus H2 and OH plus O. So this will be much more challenging. And really the hard part is these YB, LIYB or the LI2. Many of these molecules have intranuclear separation of about 6, 7, 8 atomic unit. So even if their potential may be not very deep, they can hold a large number of rotational vibration levels. And I think that's what makes the calculations really, really challenging. And so next few minutes, I would quickly give our view of some of the studies that we have done on H2, not present a lot of details, but maybe just highlight a few interesting aspects of energy transfer. So when you have two molecules colliding, it's not just quenching or rotational vibration quenching of one molecule, but if there is a transition, rotational vibration transition in one molecule, there may be it may be picked up by the other molecule. So there may be a resonant or quasi-resonant energy exchange between the two, and that can actually become very highly selective at low temperatures. So here I have H2, one H2 in vibration level V equal to one, and another in ground state. Now, if I look at the collisions of that, essentially what we see is bunch of these collection of four numbers that gives that represent V1, J1, and V2, J2 quantum numbers of the two molecules after scattering. So essentially you see in this case the most dominant one is just the elastic scattering, because the green one is 1,000 here, and all other states are kind of more or less equally populated. There is no specific final state that sticks out. But in this case, if it is V1, J2, the most dominant inelastic channel is 1,000. That would be this one. That is a pure rotational quenching of this molecule. But if I take this combination of initial state, 1,000,2, I see more than the elastic scattering channel, the 1,200 is the most prominent final channel. And so this is the inelastic channel. And so the things that kind of interesting to us was this 1,200 is obtained by swapping of the rotational quantum numbers of the two molecules. So after collision, essentially what happens is that the two molecules exchange rotational quantum number, and that also has, so this is also increasing energy. That means the energy gap between these two transitions is the smallest of all other delta E that are possible. And so essentially what we see is that the propensity for this kind of quasi-resonant transition is that internal energy should be nearly conserved. We cannot have exactly conserving because there are no combinations of rotational vibration levels where the, you know, it is exactly the same for an inelastic process. And the combined internal rotational angular momentum is also zero. That means 1200 and 1002, that means the rotational angular momentum is also unchanged before and after collision. And so we call this as sort of a quasi-resonant transition where there is a near conservation of internal energy and conservation of internal rotational angular momentum. And if I do this as a function of collision energy and plot the total inelastic versus against this quasi-resonant 1002 going to 1200, almost the entire inelastic cross section is given by this single channel. This is the next largest cross section, and there are all other inelastic cross sections corresponding to all these channels are much lower than this. So you have now I have an inelastic process that drives into a specific final state. So I have selection in the initial state and also in the final state. And that also happens if I look at the ortho collisions. 1-1 and 0-3 will go to 1-3 and 0-1, and that would be this yellow one. And the dotted lines are the total inelastic cross section. All other inelastic channels are you know, much smaller. You can look at it for a case involving para-H2 in a vibrationally excited case and ortho-H2 in vibrationally ground state. And so in this case, you cannot have a rotational exchange. In inelastic collision, you know, in ortho-H2 and para-H2, there is no exchange of rotational quantum number. But what it can do is it can exchange vibrational quantum number. So if it exchanges vibrational quantum number, this molecule becomes in V equal to 0, and this molecule becomes in V equal to 1. So essentially, we have in non-reactive, inelastic scattering, you have ortho-para transition in H2, and the energy defect for this transition is only about 8.5 Kelvin. So of course, it is not as efficient as the one before. See, here the cross-sections are very large, but here it is not that large. It is smaller than the elastic one. But the total inelastic, so in this case, so essentially it is all driven by, this is a main inelastic process. So what we did is, if it goes in this resonant way, you know, the full calculation included about 2,700 channels. And if everything is driven by this quasi-resonant process, then can be defined, can be constructed basis that involves only these quasi-resonant channels and not other channels. So we did a quick calculation with n equal to 8 that ignored all other channels that are not quasi-resonant, and we get these dotted curves here. So the dotted curves are using a calculation with n equal to 8, and the full curve is using n equal of course, we don't know this unless you do the full calculation first. So you know, there is no a priori way of finding out whether such a, you know, resonant or quasi-resonant process would occur. And I think that's a good place to stop for me.
Good. Great. Thanks.